You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
A new report to the CIA advises them to prepare for disruption in a warming world. The title of the assessment from the National Research Council is Climate and Social Stress, Implications for Security Analysis. In a strange irony, presentation of this report to the CIA was temporarily postponed as the Capitol closed down due to a violent storm, Hurricane Sandy. Our guest is John D. Steinbruner. He's a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland and chairs the 14-member panel of experts who conducted the analysis for the intelligence community. Dr. Steinbruner, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much.
Who is the intended audience for this report?
It's the U.S. government as a whole, basically. What we're trying to say is that the issue of global warming is extremely serious, and it promises to have severe disruptive effects in countries we care about, and that it is important for the government to begin monitoring both climate variables and social variables much more systematically than they're currently doing to anticipate trouble before it fully ripens.
Well, can you give us an example of a climate security threat that may have already occurred?
I can give you an example of one that is in chronic infection mode, and we mentioned that in the report, and that is Pakistan, which is clearly an internally fragile society, and it's being subjected to very severe pressure due to reduced flows in the Indus River Valley, which moderately complicated story, but it has to do with the dynamics of glacier melt in the Karakoram glaciers in the Himalayas. That is subjecting the reduced flows in the river, suggesting Pakistan to severe internal pressures because they rely on hydroelectric power generation in large parts of the country, and they also rely on water for irrigation purposes, and they're really favoring irrigation over power generation. As a result, they're getting daily or weekly, even daily riots in Pakistani villages about power outages. And there is also internal tension associated with the allocation rules for irrigation favoring the Punjab over the Sindh. Sindh is a much more arid province. And so we see the Pakistan government under increasingly severe pressure and basically not handling it all that well. And that's the type of situation we need to worry about.
Well, it's interesting you bring up Pakistan. I've been thinking about that because in the floods of 2010, which covered an estimated one-fifth of the land area, and it's a nuclear-armed country, there could have been more social breakdown, but my understanding from people who were there was that the government looked after its own supporters first and may have been strengthened by disruption in areas where they had weak control anyway. So, and another example of that same thing is U.S. hurricanes. We could say the poor response of the Bush administration weakened the federal government, while Obama's team response may have strengthened at least public perception of the necessity of a strong central government. So these events might play either way, making a government stronger or weaker. What's your thoughts on that?
We're making that point, exactly that. The net consequence of a severe climate event has a lot to do with the social reaction broadly defined. That's the coping capacity of the people immediately affected and the government's response, the responsible government's response to it. Yes, an effective response can actually strengthen governments. Part of our point is, however, is that there is good reason to expect events that are a good bit more severe than anything yet on record. And we can hope that all the government responses are going to be equitable and effective, but the chances are that some of them won't be, and we need to get prepared for the consequences of that latter situation.
Well, and I'm thinking, too, about the al-Qaeda-type radical fundamentalists that have lately established themselves in the African Sahel nations and where drought is just ravaging that area. Does climate change open the door for terrorism?
There's a distinct possibility that it does, yes. And sub-Saharan Africa is, we know, to be one of the places we need to most worry about in terms of both of conflict dynamics and climate dynamics. Yes, there is a distinct possibility that chronic pressures of this sort will create conditions that inspire not only terrorism, but sort of local civil conflict, strong enough that it requires international response. The difficulty here is that we know beyond reasonable doubt that the consequences are going to be very large. But we do not know, unfortunately, the timing, magnitude, location, all the particulars with sufficient precision to make confident predictions. And so what we're saying is you have to look for trouble. You have to expect it to occur. Trouble of a magnitude we haven't encountered yet before, so something beyond recent experience or any experience. We need to monitor more carefully to pick it up earlier so that we don't sort of get too surprised and that we're prepared. It's a very abstract argument and sort of going outside the bounds of experience and saying there's reason to do that, but, you know, it's difficult, I imagine, for people to, it's an abstraction and it's difficult for them to absorb.
Well, yes, indeed. The National Research Council talks about, quote, climate surprises in the decades to come. And I can see things like that. We could have frozen methane on the sea floor. The clath rates could suddenly melt. We might have a burst of warming we didn't look for. Would you elaborate on this idea of climate surprises?
We were looking at adaptation issues rather than mitigation. When you're talking about sort of the release of frozen methane on the seafloor, that is, we put in the category of a tipping event, sort of passing a threshold where suddenly you get a feedback process that really makes the whole situation globally a lot more dangerous. We looked hard at that, and we had to admit that there's no scientific basis for projecting such an event within the next decade. Our time frame was within a decade. So what we did is said, however, we do know enough to say that we should expect adaptation difficulties in some places over the course of a decade and then with increasing frequency and severity thereafter. And adaptation is more a localized effect, a climate effect that is focused in a particular area, even though there may be global consequences to it. And it, again, carries the affected societies outside the bounds of their coping capability. So that's a narrower view than the more global view of potentially globally catastrophic tipping effects.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about the American intelligence community and their need to prepare for extreme climate events as a national security problem. Professor John D. Steinbruner is also director of the Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland. John, other military analysts have long suggested the next major war may be triggered over water shortages and water access. You did talk about Pakistan. Does global warming make that threat more serious?
Global warming certainly is affecting water dynamics, and these have very big consequences for societies. That said, it's not easy to fight over water. It's very difficult to nearly impossible to seize control of a watershed and then thereafter allocate water inequitably within the watershed. That is way outside the bounds of what is considered permissible. And even though you might imagine it, nobody's really going to be able to do that. That said, however, the interaction of water issues can exacerbate tensions that already exist, particularly, for example, between India and Pakistan over water flows in the Indus River. Pakistan government actually blames India for the reduced flow in the river, even though the evidence suggests that it is a climate change phenomenon. So it is playing into a relationship that is already tense. It is difficult to imagine how that situation alone is going to generate a war because, again, you cannot seize control of a watershed effectively. Nobody has the capacity to do that. And therefore, sort of in the end of the day, if you have water allocation issues, it really forces even the most severe opponents to some form of accommodation. But that said, it can really induce serious tension in relationships that are already tense and have triggering effects if it's not the prime cause.
Well, Dr. Steinbruner, before releasing the report, your group presented it to the CIA. Did you get some interest, and is there any way to judge how seriously the CIA or even, say, Homeland Security take climate disruption?
Well, let me say that the target of the report was not just the CIA. It was the entire intelligence community and, indeed, the entire government. But, yes, I would say that those parts of the government that are involved in security issues are very attentive. I mean, it's not difficult to get their attention. They understand that this potential issue is very serious. Naturally enough, they want specificity. They need to know, okay, what specifically might happen, what kind of problems. And it's, of course, difficult to give them specificity based upon what we really know at the moment. So basically what we're saying to them is the government as a whole needs to do more refined, more careful, more systematic monitoring of this unfolding story. And if you do that, you will have, with better evidence, we will be able to inform you better. It's an interaction between what we know and what we can measure.
And what role could the intelligence community play in that? How can they adapt?
Well, the intelligence community obviously has major assets for gathering data. And part of what we're saying is combine yourself, align with the scientific community to work out what data we most need to gather and how we ought to use it. Put yourself and the rest of the government in a better position to understand the story as it unfolds. And, you know, part of the message is you cannot do this only by yourself with your traditional secretive methods. Okay, this is a global problem, a global story. It's going to require globally vetted, globally authorized arrangements, and we need to start doing that.
Right, because, you know, I worry whether the intelligence agencies, even if they see something coming for a particular government, would they share it with other government agencies and the public? As we learned from 9/11, critical information can become compartmentalized. And right now, governments in some countries are either publicly denying climate change or trying to avoid talking about it. If their intelligence agencies see a real threat, would the public even find out in time to protect themselves?
Yeah, that is a real issue. I mean, and this is, I think, really a fundamental problem maybe with American culture as a whole. We have problems sharing. There's something about American child-rearing practices that are a little defective in that regard. And what we're trying to say is you've got to share information here, not only within the government, but with globally, okay? If you want to set up a monitoring system, everybody is going to have to contribute to it and get benefit from it, which means that we have to agree on what it is we're monitoring and why we're doing it and how we do it and all that. And access is going to have to be equitable. You cannot just restrict it to any national intelligence agency. You know, just being a little specific for a moment, the U.S., of course, is very interested in precipitation in South Asia. It's one of the things we know we need to monitor. We do this in satellites, okay, but we don't get enough precision with that without ground station monitoring data, which neither India or Pakistan will give to us. India wants to sell it, which violates our sense of how this should work, and Pakistan classifies the information. So we've got a lot of discussing to go to set up an arrangement where everybody agrees to provide detailed data and gets commensurate benefits from the aggregate system. There's a lot of talk and institutional organization in front of us to set up an arrangement of that sort, and we're telling the intelligence communities that's the way you've got to think about it, not in your normal secretive way, but in an open, globally vetted way.
Well, on a more personal level, John Steinbruner, you blogged about a book by Fred Guterl, the executive director of Scientific American. It's called Fate of the Species, Why the Human Race May Cause Its Own Extinction and How We Can Stop It. I'm wondering, did the NRC or have you thought about the possibility that runaway climate change could bring about human extinction?
It's a possibility we cannot exclude. That's what I would say. We are adding CO2 to the atmosphere at a rate that exceeds anything we've seen in the entire 65-million-year paleoclimate record. We've never added at this rate, ever. And that means that we're providing a thermal impulse that will have to be balanced in some way at an unprecedented rate, and that says we're looking at big events here, the possibility of big events. So you cannot preclude that the consequences are large enough to put, you know, the viability of the species in question. Nobody believes that that's a short-term question. If that proved to be a short-term question, we would all be stunned and astounded. But it is a long-term question, and we're not yet prepared to cope with it. So the warning is well taken. The last part of the book, how to keep it from happening, there's not much in the book about that. And it's not his fault. It's that there's not much to say as yet about that. We don't yet know or have not yet organized what we need to do to preclude this possibility. And so we're trying to say, basically, this is a very big deal. It's going to have major consequences. We're going to have to deal with it much more in greater detail and much more seriously than we're currently doing. And the Guterl warning helps in that regard to the extent anybody pays attention to it.
Well, in a surprise, you found climate instability may not be totally bad. Tyrants may have a harder time, or maybe people will develop a larger sense of sharing. Talk to us about that.
I think there is a lot of constructive opportunity here, actually. There are definitely things that can be done. We could bring, if you will, the global warming impulse under control in, say, half a century by an organized transformation of energy generation globally. That'll ultimately have to be done anyway if we make a big deal of it. And by the way, that's a very productive way of diverting investment assets that I think are finding some difficulty being productive. It just requires thinking on a global scale and diverting, if you will, current energy markets off onto a different track by deliberate public action. It's a matter of, if you will, organizing public policy much more decisively on a much broader scale than we're used to doing. If we did do that, many things, many security issues could be substantially benefited, if you will. So it is an opportunity for reforming or sort of putting our international relationships on a much more productive basis. And, if you will, recognizing a common interest that requires common action and requires it enough that it actually occurs. So there's a lot that is actually positive in this situation.
Well, I'm thinking, too, about people who are engulfed in a climate emergency, whether they're in Asia or in the Rockaways of New York. They may have to create an instant community of self-help. Maybe we'll see more localization and resilience developing as big weather events strike with more regularity. What are your thoughts on that?
That is certainly part of the story. When you're talking about these weather episodes such as Sandy, the resilience of the local community matters a whole lot. And the ability, if you will, to give help to local communities from remote locations is a major question. I mean, as we're seeing, we think that we responded to Sandy reasonably well, but the people in Brooklyn who are still without power don't think so, and they are right not to think so. So Sandy tells us that our ability, which we think is more advanced than some other places, is still not adequate to events of this magnitude. And therefore, we need to get better at it at all levels, locally, nationally, and globally. And the internet, the interaction, this sort of flow of information, potentially at any rate, helps in that regard. I was told, for example, I live in Washington, D.C., there was somebody in our neighborhood who was going around collecting food and blankets and other things and driving them up to New York to the neighborhoods in question, not waiting for government relief agencies to do this, just literally doing it on an individual basis. Enough people do that, it would make a difference.
Well, that is a plot I would like to see succeed. You have been listening to Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Professor John D. Steinbruner about a report by the National Research Council for the American Intelligence Community and the government. It's titled Climate and Social Stress Implications for Security Analysis. You can find links to all that in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Professor Steinbruner, thank you for sharing your time with Radio EcoShock listeners.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.